Good morning. Ready for day five? All right, last day. All right, we're going to go in and finish up talking about cryptography, and then we're going to wrap up by looking at governance and policy and risk and incident response, sort of everything else that's needed in order to effectively secure our control systems. So as we've talked about, we started off laying the foundation with the terminology. We then spent day two looking at how the adversary works. We spent day three securing our servers, day four securing our network resources, firewalls, data diodes, and today, day five, we put all of the support structure around it, the governance, the compliance, the certifications, the incident response, the policies, all the other pieces that are needed to securely and effectively run those systems. So if let's go ahead and finish up Book four by looking at cryptography, and then we'll jump into ICS and governance. Crypto plays a critical part in our security arsenal in not only protecting data, but protecting control systems. Now, I know I often get pushback saying, but Eric, crypto is for confidentiality, and confidentiality is not always a primary concern in control systems. Actually, two caveats to that. Crypto is for confidentiality, integrity, and authentication. So in control system communication with remote field devices, we absolutely need authentication and we absolutely need integrity. So even though most people only think of crypto in the realm of confidentiality, it also is a critical component of integrity and authentication. So because those are also important, we need to understand how to roll it out correctly. Second, when we say confidentiality is not important in control systems, that's not a true statement. When it comes to communicating with remote field devices, availability and integrity tend to be more important than confidentiality. So when we're talking about the communication with sensors and remote field devices, that's where typically the availability and integrity are important. But confidentiality is still a key role inside your supervisory network. If you go in and look at your critical information, think of a data historian. What if an adversary got full access to all your logs? How about the blueprints for your plant? What if somebody got full access to your entire setup and control? What about the output of your vulnerability scans? What if an adversary got a complete listing of all your exposures, all your vulnerabilities, and all the ways into your organization? That would absolutely be devastating to your environment. So we have to be careful here that while, yes, in certain situations, confidentiality might not be as important as the integrity, availability, and authentication is, but there are absolutely critical places within our control system environment where we must preserve the confidentiality of that information. So all of these play an important role. Now, the problem with crypto, everyone's using it, everyone's deploying it, and many organizations are not using it correctly. In so many cases, we do authorized pen test attack vectors against control systems. We break in, we own every network segment, we control the entire supervisory network, and when we outbrief the executives on how bad their security is, you know what their comment is? Well, how'd you get in? I thought we had encryption. How did you get around our encryption? And you know what our typical response is? What encryption? If crypto is not done correctly, it's not going to provide the proper level of protection. One of the craziest terms that I hear organizations use is transparent encryption. We're encrypting all critical information, but we're doing it transparent to our user, so there's no inconvenience to them. Think about that. If your encryption is transparent to your user, if it's transparent to the customer, then it's transparent to the attacker. And that's the exact problem, is it was transparent to us. And guess what? If it was transparent to us, then it was ineffective because it didn't do anything to slow us down. So in order for crypto to work, we have to make sure we're properly implementing it and designing it within our environment, which means there's some core rules of crypto that we need to make sure you understand in deploying encryption solutions to make sure they are working correctly. Just like a firewall that's misconfigured doesn't do any good, just like an IDS that's misconfigured doesn't do any good, crypto that's misconfigured does not do any good either. Now, when we go in and when we talk about crypto, it's really part of a bigger discipline called cryptology. Cryptology is broken into two pieces. Cryptography is the art and science of building and deploying systems that conceal the meaning of information. And cryptanalysis is the art and science of testing and validating those algorithms. So when we look at the overall discipline of cryptology, it's about building algorithms that can conceal the meaning of it. And cryptography is the art and science of deploying those algorithms. And cryptanalysis is the art and science of testing and validating those algorithms. Now, if we want to look at the literal meaning of cryptography, cryptography actually comes from the ancient Greek derivation of kryptos, which means hidden, and graphion, which means writing. So cryptography literally means hidden writing. You are hiding or concealing the meaning of the information. To understand this a little better, let's go in and break crypto down into its core fundamental components. What we're doing with crypto is we're going in and we're taking a piece of information in its original form, which is what we call a message. So a message is anything in its original unencrypted state. We use that word message generically. A message can be an executable. It can be a Word document. It can be a PowerPoint. It can be a JPEG. It can be anything in its original unencrypted state. Actually, to get even more fundamental, a message is a string of binary information that has meaning to a program. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, when we're talking about any data in a computer, it's really binary data. So this message is a string of ones and zeros that has some meaning to some program, whether it's a Word document, an Excel spreadsheet, or a JPEG. And then we're going to take that binary data that has meaning, and we're going to run it through a mathematical transformation known as an encryption algorithm. And that encryption algorithm is going to take that binary data that has meaning, and it's going to produce random data known as ciphertext. So in essence, what encryption is doing, it's taking information that has meaning and converting it to random data or meaningless information. So now if anyone gets that ciphertext, because it's random, there is no meaning to that info. So we are concealing the content of that message. Then we can take that random binary data. We can run it through a decryption algorithm and we can get back the original information. So encryption is pretty straightforward. We're taking binary data that has meaning. We're performing some mathematical process against it that creates random meaningless data. And then if any adversary intercepts our ciphertext, they can't find out anything. And then we can take that ciphertext, that random data, and we can run it through a decryption mathematical process and get back the original information. Now the problem with the way this is written up here is if I want to protect my ciphertext, I would have to protect the decryption algorithm. Because the way I've wrote it, if somebody has the decryption algorithm, they would be able to get back our message. Well, that's not what I want. These encryption and decryption algorithms are hard to write, and we want to go in and reuse them over and over again. So we want to go in and create something unique so the encryption and decryption algorithms don't have to be protected. Well, to understand this, think of this hotel. The encryption and decryption is like a lock. If you walk around this hotel, every hotel room has the same lock on each door. It's not the lock that keeps your content protected. It's the key. The key is what allows me to get into my room and not into anyone else's room. It's the secrecy of the key that keeps the contents of my room safe, not the secrecy of the lock. So what we're going to do is we're going to go in and encrypt a message with a key to get back to ciphertext, and then decrypt the ciphertext with a key to get back the original message. So it's actually the secrecy and protection of the key that keeps our content safe. Now, this is where, when we go from the real world to cyber, we often forget about the key fundamental principles. In the real world, I don't think there's anyone that will argue with me that in order to keep the contents of your room safe, you need to protect and control the key. I'll even take it a step further. I bet if right now I asked every one of you to show me the key of where you're sleeping tonight, I bet you in less than a minute, 90% of you could show me your key. I personally keep the key in my pocket. You might keep it in your wallet, your pocketbook, your briefcase, but we all recognize keeping that key protected, and we all have that key somewhere close to us right now. And if I ask you to produce it, you absolutely can. We all get that. We understand and we follow it. But when we go to cyber, we forget about that. How many of you do online banking or financial transactions and you go in and they utilize encryption to protect your banking information? Most of you. Now, if I asked you all to open up your computer and show me your key, I bet less than 1% of you could show it to me. Why? You don't have it. Where is the key stored? With your data. Do we see a problem with that? Let me give you the analogy of how many organizations do crypto. What if I'm always losing my key? I always leave my key in the hotel room. I'm actually doing really, really good on this trip. In the United States, we don't really care about the environment. So you can leave your hotel lights on all the time. So when I go into my room in the US, literally you open the door and the key goes right in my pocket. So I never ever lose my key. Over here, where you have to use your key to turn on the lights to conserve energy, which I like. Now the problem is when I leave my hotel room, I have to remember to take the key out because that's not something we normally do in the United States. So I'm normally locking myself out. So far this trip, I haven't done it once. Now bringing it up, I probably will do it later today, but I've been actually really good here. So what if I'm always losing my key and I have a brilliant idea? I'm going to tape the key to the outside of the door. This way, whenever I come back to my room, the key will always be there. So now I could take the key, open the door, and retape it to the outside of the door. You're all laughing. Why? Because it doesn't work. If I store the key with the lock, it defeats the purpose of it. Yet you shouldn't be laughing, because unfortunately that's what a lot of sites do with crypto. They store the key with the data, which is like taping it to the door and not doing any good. So if you're implementing crypto in your control system environments, you need to ask yourself three questions. Where is the key? Who has access to the key? And how is the key protected, controlled, and managed? It's all about controlling, managing, and protecting the key. Now, there's another misconception that we have to clear up. This encryption and decryption algorithms are mathematical transformations. How do we verify the robustness of a cryptographic algorithm? How do we go in and verify the security of those algorithms. You ready for this? You can't. There is no way to prove an algorithm is secure. There is no battery of tests that you can run and come back and say, this is a secure algorithm. Well, great. If there's no way to prove an algorithm is secure, then how do we have any faith or trust in those algorithms? That's where cryptanalysis comes in. Cryptanalysis is the art and science of trying to break an algorithm. So the way we verify the integrity of an algorithm is by having really smart people try to break it. And if they can't for a long period of time, then we have faith and trust in those algorithms. That brings up two interesting rules. Rule one, the only way to prove an algorithm has any robustness is by publicly disclosing it so smart people can break it, which means never trust proprietary algorithms. A proprietary algorithm is an algorithm that hasn't been verified, hasn't been validated and tested, and history has shown us that proprietary algorithms almost always have vulnerabilities. Writing good crypto is really hard and really difficult, and the chances of somebody writing an algorithm that no one else has verified and getting it correct is very, very, very slim. So we never trust proprietary algorithms. But won't disclosing the algorithm make it easier for somebody to break? Not if it's robust crypto. With robust crypto, even if I disclose the algorithm, it doesn't make it any easier for somebody to break. So if you're doing good crypto and I show you the algorithm, it will not make it any easier for somebody to break or compromise, which means when you have vendors, which is very common, it's getting less common, but unfortunately it has been common in the past, in control systems that are using proprietary encryption, you should be really, really concerned, because if it's not done correctly and it hasn't been verified, you might not be getting any protection. A weak algorithm isn't really protecting or controlling your data. So we never want to trust proprietary algorithms. Second, if the only way to know the strength of an algorithm is if it's been verified, validated, and tested, that means we only want to use an algorithm after 10 or 12 years, because we want it to be tested for 10 years to make sure it's robust. Never trust brand new algorithms. All of the algorithms that we utilize that are considered to be secure today are algorithms that are 10 or 12 years old that have been out for a long period of time. So all of that boils down to our golden rule of crypto in control systems, which is the secrecy of our ciphertext is based on the secrecy of the key, not the secrecy of the algorithm. So this becomes our driving rule. The secrecy of our information is based on the secrecy of the key, not the secrecy of the algorithm. So what you want to do with your crypto is you want to go in and ask yourself two big questions. Question one, are we using public, vetted, well-accepted algorithms, i.e. not using proprietary brand new algorithms? And second, are we protecting, controlling, and securing the key? If you do those two things, you win. If you don't do those two things, you lose. And the two areas where we see lots of mistakes being made in control systems is many organizations are utilizing proprietary algorithms and they're not protecting and controlling the keys. They're keeping the keys stored with the information. A common attack that we'll often do is, as we mentioned yesterday, if you're going to go in and utilize encryption or Bluetooth and you have 5,000 remote field devices, you're going to go in and configure all of them the exact same way. So if I can break into one of them and steal the key, I now have the key for everything and I can get into everyone. It's sort of like going in and using the same key for every hotel room. All I have to do is get one and then I could open up every room. That's how a lot of these control systems are set up where everything's using the same key. So once one key is compromised, all the doors can be opened up quickly. So we always want to go in and focus on the robustness of the algorithm and make sure the keys are properly protected, controlled, and locked down. Now we want to talk about this key in a little more detail. What is a key? A key is a binary string of information. A key is a series of zeros and ones. Now, what can you do with any series of zeros and ones? You can brute force it. I can go in and I could try every possible combination, run it through, and eventually break your encryption, which means all crypto is crackable. It's only a matter of time. So what would conventional wisdom state? The longer the key, the harder it is to brute force. The shorter the key, the easier it is to brute force. If you don't believe me, I will prove it to you. I have a 2-bit key. Go in and try to break it. 00011011. 3 seconds. Now, I have a 15-bit key. Try to brute force it. 00000000000001000000. It's going to take you a lot longer. So even in that simple example, if I gave you a 2-bit key and a 15-bit key, you can see that the 15-bit would take longer than the 2-bit. So because the longer the key, the harder it is to brute force, and the longer our information is protected, what do organizations typically do? They go in and they focus on key length. They go and try to make their keys really, really long. Now, yes, key length is important. If you look at a 40-bit key and you look at a 128-bit key, the 128-bit key is approximately a trillion times more protection if you look at the entropy of the various options that are available. It's not a linear, it's an exponential increase in the difficulty of breaking it. So because of this, organizations tend to focus energy on key length, key length, key length. What's the problem? Key length only matters if the key is secure. If your key is not secure, who cares about the key length? You could have the longest key on planet Earth, and if I can get a hold of it, game over. This would be like going in and having a really, really robust key for my hotel room, and I taped the key to the outside of the door. The robust key is useless if the key is not secure. Now, yes, key length is important after you protect the key. I would rather you have a shorter key that's protected than a longer key that's not protected. So, yes, key length is important, but it's secondary. First, is the key safe? Second, is the key length sufficient? Now, I often get people say, but if keys can always be brute forced, then our information can always be exposed. Yes, but remember, most information doesn't have to be protected for infinity. There's a life of that information. So here's our rule in picking the key length. You want to pick a long enough key length so by the time somebody brute forces it, the useful life of the information has expired. So the question is, how long does this information need to be protected? And then we want to pick a key length that's longer than the useful life of that info to brute force it. So if my information needs to be protected for 3 years, I'm going to pick a key length that can be brute forced in 5 years. So by the time somebody brute forces it, the information has expired. Right now, this is sort of the crypto landscape. These are the algorithms that we're typically going to be using that have been vetted. A few have some issues that we'll talk about as we finish up and go through this module. Essentially, you have three types of algorithms. Symmetric is for confidentiality. Asymmetric is for authentication. And hashing is for integrity. Now, I'll prove to you what I said earlier in that we never use brand new algorithms. If you look at every algorithm up here is on average 22 years old, and there's no algorithm that's younger than 14 years. Every algorithm up here is at least 14 years old or older, which proves my point. We never trust brand new algorithms. There is no algorithm up here that's 1 to 2 years old. There is no algorithm up here that's 8 or 9 years old. All the algorithms are 14 years or older, and the average age is 22 years. So that proves our point of never trust brand new algorithms. Also, there's not a single algorithm up here that's proprietary. Every one of these algorithms, I can give you the algorithm. You can publicly find it on the internet, and you can go through and examine the entire algorithm. And this is the big picture of algorithms we're utilizing today. And if everyone is public and everyone has been out for at least 14 years, that drives home our points of never trust brand new and never trust proprietary algorithms. Now, when we look at the challenges that we face, there's really three things we need to deal with crypto. We need to protect our data at rest. We need to protect our data in transit, and we need to manage and protect the keys. So those are the three things we focus on. Now, here's the problem in crypto. There is no partial credit. I often get clients come back saying, Eric, we're doing two out of the three. I said, fail. You either do all three and you win, or you don't do all three and you lose. Because remember, if you do two out of three, and I'm the adversary, I'm going to exploit your weakest link. So if you protect your data at rest and protect your data in transit, but you don't protect the keys, I steal the key. If you protect the key and you protect your data at rest, I steal your data in transit. So with crypto, there's no partial credit. You have to go after all three. The data has to be protected at rest. The data has to be protected in transit. And the keys must be managed, controlled, and secured. So that's going to be your high-level checklist when you go back to work next week. You're going to go into your environment, and you're going to ask yourself three things. Okay, how are we protecting our data at rest? How are we protecting our data in transit? And how are we managing and controlling the keys? That becomes an easy identifiable checklist for you to be able to verify and see how you're protecting it. From a vendor perspective, you would do the same thing. You would look at your products and say, okay, how are we protecting the data at rest with our products? How are we protecting our data in transit? And how are we managing and controlling the keys? And if the vendor's not, then you need to communicate that to the client, that the client's responsible for that, or is the vendor. You need to identify who is managing and protecting that cryptographic life cycle. Now, when we look at crypto, there are three primary goals with three primary algorithms. For confidentiality, protecting your information from being disclosed, we always use symmetric encryption. For integrity, to protect the information from being altered, we always use hashing. And for authentication, we always use asymmetric. So those are the three primary algorithms with respective goals. Confidentiality, we always use symmetric algorithms. Integrity, we always use hashing algorithms. And authentication, we always use asymmetric. Now, you might be saying, Eric, you keep saying three goals, but there's four boxes. Why are there four boxes? Because the fourth goal is merely just a combination. Non-repudiation is being able to prove that you agreed to a specific instance of an agreement. And non-repudiation is nothing more than hashing and authentication together. So this box is really just integrity and authentication. That's why the non-repudiated feature that you use all the time is your signature. So if we want to do this in a cyber sense, we would need a digital signature, which is nothing more than asymmetric for authentication and hashing for integrity. So this is important because you want to make sure that you go in and use the right algorithm. So you should use this checklist and say, okay, What are the goals that you need to achieve in your environment? Well, if you need to achieve integrity, then you want to verify that you're using hash algorithms. If you need to achieve confidentiality, then you want to make sure you're using symmetric algorithms. And I know when I present it in this manner, this seems obvious, but I can't tell you how many times we go to clients and they tell us the primary goal is integrity, yet they're using symmetric algorithms. You're not aligned with the operational goals. So this provides a very nice checklist for you to go through, and you start off at the top. You start off by saying, okay, which of these four goals do you want? Then you verify that the algorithms that are used are aligned with the respective goals within your organization. So we always want to verify that we're using the right solution for the right problem. So if we go in and we look at a high-level chart of what we're doing, whenever we want to achieve confidentiality, we use symmetric algorithms. Symmetric encryption is one key crypto. We use one key to encrypt, and we use the same key to decrypt. So if Tim and Eric wanted to protect the confidentiality of our information using symmetric encryption, we would both have a copy of the same key. I would use the key to encrypt, and Tim would use the key to decrypt. That key in symmetric encryption is called the secret key. And the secret key, well, needs to be kept secret. Why? If you use one key to both encrypt and decrypt, then that means anybody who has the key can decrypt the information. So therefore, Tim and I need to protect it to make sure no one else has access to that key, because if they do, they can read or gain control of our info. Asymmetric is two-key crypto. There's two keys. Now, the way asymmetric works is anything encrypted with one key can only be decrypted with the second key. So if I encrypt something with key one, can I decrypt it with key one? No, I can only decrypt it with key two. If I encrypt something with key two, can I decrypt it with key two? No, I can only decrypt it with key one. So in asymmetric encryption, we actually have two keys, and whatever is encrypted with one key can only be decrypted with the second key. Now, instead of calling this key one and key two, let's call these keys public and private. Now, the same rules apply. Anything that's encrypted with the public key can only be decrypted with the private key, and anything encrypted with the private key can only be decrypted with the public key. Now, the benefit of asymmetric is I can go in and give anyone my public key. Now, public keys are normally distributed via digital certificates to prove that it came from that person, but anybody can have my public key. I don't have to keep it protected. I only have to protect my private key. Now, if anybody has my public key and they want to go in and encrypt information for me, if they encrypt something with the public key, can anyone else with the public key decrypt it? No, because once it's encrypted with the public key, it can only be decrypted with the private key, which is the only key that I have. So now if all of you have my public key, and you're all encrypting information with my public key, that's great, because I'm the only one with the private key, and I'm the only one that can decrypt that info. So asymmetric allows us to publicly distribute the public key, and we only have to keep the private key secure. Now, symmetric and asymmetric is what we call reversible encryption, because I can take plain text, I can encrypt it and get the ciphertext. I could take the ciphertext with a key and decrypt it and get back the original information. So with symmetric encryption, I can both encrypt and decrypt the data. Hashing is irreversible encryption. Hashing takes information of any length and produces a fixed length output. And given the output, it is impossible to ever produce the original input. So it is irreversible encryption. So literally, if I take a file and I run it through a hash and I get the output, there is no possible way I can ever get the original input from that output. It is totally and completely irreversible. Great. Then what's the value? The value of hashing is the only way the outputs are supposed to be the same is if the inputs are the same. So now if I go in and I take a critical piece of information and I run it through a hash, and then a week, a month, or a year later, I want to prove that the information hasn't been altered, I run it through a hash again, and if the hashes are the same, that means the input was the same. If the hashes were different, that means the input was altered or modified. So we can use hashing as a form of integrity, because the only way the outputs are supposed to be the same is if the inputs are the same. Now let's go in and look at each of these in just a little more detail so we can really understand some implementation components in our environment. Symmetric encryption is very fast. It's very quick. It's very robust. That's why we always use it for confidentiality. If we want to protect the confidentiality of our information, we're going to take the info, run it through a symmetric algorithm with a secret key, and get the ciphertext. And then the person on the other end is going to take the ciphertext, decrypt it with the secret key, and get back the original information. Now, there's one problem that we run into with symmetric encryption. If we have Alice and we have Bob, and they need to communicate over a channel that's not secure. So they have a non-secure channel. Therefore, they want to encrypt the information with symmetric encryption to preserve the confidentiality of the data. That's great. But what's the issue? In order for this to work, Alice and Bob both need to have the same key. Now, wait. If this network is not secure for them to send the data unencrypted, it's not secure for them to send the plain text key. Because if they just send the key over the network, anyone could intercept it and decrypt their data. Therefore, in order for Alice and Bob to utilize symmetric encryption for confidentiality over a non-secure channel, they need to go in and have a secure channel to exchange the key. They need to have a way to securely get the key between the two parties. Now, the question I normally get from students is, well, wait, if there's a secure channel for the key, why not just use the secure channel for the data and not even worry about symmetric? Here's the reason. This secure channel that we're going to use for the key is a low bandwidth, inefficient channel. So for sending a small key one time is okay, but sending large amounts of data is very, very inefficient. So we're going to go in and need a low bandwidth channel to exchange the key, and then we use symmetric for the confidentiality of the remaining data. It turns out in symmetric, there are three ways of achieving a secure channel: a pre-shared key, asymmetric, and Diffie-Hellman key exchange. A pre-shared key is where you go in and you take the two entities that need to communicate and you bring them together, give them both the key, and then separate them out. When we set up VPN concentrators for our clients between different operating sites, we're going to get the VPN concentrators in our lab. I'm going to enter the key into each one of the systems, and then we're going to ship them out to their respective locations. So now if the two devices or entities or people can be together, we can share the key locally and then separate out the two parties so they can communicate. Typically, pre-shared key only works in VPN concentrators where you actually can get the two devices together prior to shipping them out. The second method of achieving a secure channel is to use asymmetric encryption, where everybody has the public key, and then what will happen is this. Alice will now go in, and she will take the secret key and encrypt it with Bob's public key and send it across the wire, and then Bob will use his private key to decrypt it and get the secret key. So now we used asymmetric as the secure channel for the secret key, and now that both parties have the secret key, we can use that with symmetric encryption. Now, the comment I often get back from students is, well, wait a second. Why don't we just go in and encrypt the entire message with Bob's public key, send it across the wire, use Bob's private key to decrypt the message? Why are we even messing around with using the keys? Technically, that would work. Technically, you could go in and encrypt the message with the public key and decrypt it with the private. However, no one does that in practice because asymmetric encryption is very, very slow. So if you have a potentially large message and you have a potentially smaller key and you have a fast algorithm and you have a slow algorithm, you're going to use the slow algorithm for the smaller data, which is the key, and you're going to use the fast symmetric for the larger message. So because symmetric is significantly faster than asymmetric, we're going to always want to use the faster algorithm for our message and use the slower asymmetric just for our key. So that's the second way of achieving a secure channel, is by using asymmetric encryption. The third method is Diffie-Hellman key exchange. Diffie-Hellman key exchange allows two parties in the presence of an adversary to exchange a key so only they know the key. So literally, Tim and myself could have an open conversation and we would be able to exchange the key without anyone else knowing what that key is. Now, for the level of this class, for a Control System Security Essentials class, you just need to understand that symmetric encryption requires a secure channel, and the three ways of achieving the secure channel is going to be pre-shared keys used for VPN concentrators, asymmetric encryption used for email, SSL, and full disk encryption, and Diffie-Hellman key exchange used for clientless VPNs. However, we often get smart students in class that push back and say, but Eric, how does Diffie-Hellman really work? How can two parties in the presence of an adversary go in and exchange a key without anyone knowing what it is? So because we usually get curious students, I have included the algorithm here if you'd like to go through it and look at it, but it is beyond the scope of the knowledge you would need in order to manage and ask the right questions for security. So we don't actually cover it in class. We just give it there as a reference if you're curious how it works. What you need to do from your position in security is you need to determine for symmetric encryption which method are you using to exchange the key in a secure manner, because yes, I have been in control system environments where you have remote field devices that are using symmetric encryption for confidentiality because the channel is not secure and they're sending the key plain text across that channel. That doesn't do any good from a crypto perspective. So you need to recognize that symmetric is used for confidentiality. Symmetric requires a secure channel, and you need to verify and validate that secure channel. So symmetric is for confidentiality of the message. Now, asymmetric has two uses. The first use is as a secure channel for symmetric encryption. So we can use asymmetric as a secure way to transfer the secret key for symmetric encryption. So we could take our symmetric key. We can encrypt it with the recipient's public key. They can decrypt it with their private key and get back the original symmetric key on that system. Now, there's another use for asymmetric. What if I go in and I encrypt a message with my private key? If I encrypt a message with my private key and send it out, who can decrypt it? Well, anyone with my public key, which would be anyone. Anyone can get my public key. So there wouldn't be any confidentiality in doing that. But wait. If you receive an encrypted message and you successfully decrypt it with the public key, what does that mean? That means it must have been encrypted with the private key, and the only person who has the private key is Eric. So therefore, you just proved that message came from Eric, which is authentication. So by encrypting messages with the sender's private key, anyone with the public key can verify that it was encrypted with the private key. And because the only person with the private key is that person, we can use that as a form of authentication. So encrypting messages with sender's private keys is how you can authenticate that the message really came from that person. And then finally, our last method or algorithm is hashing. And hashing is used for integrity. We take messages of any possible length and we produce a fixed length output. And then we can store it in a secure location and we can rerun those hashes at set intervals, compare them. And if they're the same, we know the message hasn't been altered. And if they're different, we know the message has. Remember when we talked about tripwire on day 3? Tripwire used cryptographic hashing for verification of the integrity of our messages. So the way this would work is I would take the message, I would run it through a hash algorithm, and then I would send you the hash algorithm with the message. You would then go in, you would take the message, run it through a hash, compare it to the hash that I sent you, and if the two hashes are the same, I know the message hasn't been altered. Now, does anyone see a problem with the way I have this drawn? If I'm taking a message and I want you to be able to prove it hasn't been altered, so I take this message, I run it through a hash, and I get the hash output, and then over a plain text public network, I'm sending you the message and I'm sending you the hash. What could any adversary do? Any adversary can change the message, rerun a hash, and send you a new message with a new hash. And then you would go in, you would run the hash of the message, they would match, and you'd say good to go. And you would never know that that message was altered. So hashing is good, but you need a way to verify that the hash hasn't been altered in transit. And the way we do that is with a digital signature. A digital signature is where I take the hash of your message and I encrypt it with the sender's private key. Now, because it's encrypted with the sender's private key, now no one can intercept it. Because if they do intercept it and they change the message and they create a new hash, they don't have the private key, so they can't re-encrypt that information. So that's how now we can verify that it hasn't been altered. So let's show you what this looks like. I'm going to take my message, run it through a hash and create the hash. I'm then going to encrypt the hash with asymmetric encryption with the sender's private key. And I'm going to send that with the message. Then the recipient is going to take the signature, decrypt it with the sender's public key, and get the original hash, rerun a hash of the message, and compare the hashes. If the hashes match we know the message hasn't been altered. And because we've successfully decrypted with the sender's public key, we know it came from that person. Now, because we're taking a message, running it through the hash, and encrypting the hash with the sender's private key, now if somebody intercepts the message, yeah, they can change the message. Yeah, they can run a new hash. But because they don't have the private key, they can't re-encrypt. So that's why the digital signature works. So two steps. We're taking the message, we're running it through a hash for integrity, and then we're encrypting the hash with asymmetric encryption with the sender's private key for authentication. We're sending both pieces. The recipient's taking the encrypted signature, decrypting it with the sender's public key to get the hash to prove it came from that person, taking the message, running it through a hash, and if the hashes match, we now know it also hasn't been altered in our environment. So that's how we do the digital signatures or verification of the integrity of the information. So at this point, we have now looked at the encryption in our environment. Your assessment process for crypto should go like this. You should go back to work and say, okay, what goals are we trying to achieve? If you're trying to achieve confidentiality, you use symmetric. If you're trying to use integrity, hashing. If you're trying to achieve authentication, asymmetric. And if you want non-repudiated feature, then it's going to be asymmetric and hashing together. That's step one. Step two, verify that the algorithms that you're using are publicly validated algorithms that are not proprietary and well-trusted. Third, determine the length or useful life of the information and make sure your key length is appropriate. And then finally, make sure the key is protected, secured, and kept safe so someone can't get access to it. That's essentially the process we go through with crypto. We figure out the goals. We align it to the algorithms. We verify the algorithm. We determine the length of the information. We verify the length of the key, and we protect the key. If you follow those steps, you win on crypto. If you don't follow those steps, you lose. Because crypto doesn't work if it's a proprietary algorithm. Crypto doesn't work if the keys are not kept secure. And crypto doesn't work if the key length is not appropriate based on the useful life of our data. So now that we've gone in and we finished up crypto, which wraps up book four, we're now going to go in and jump into the final book on the final day of the class, which is going to be our governance and resources for protecting and securing our systems. So the question is, how does crypto work for online banking? With online banking, you're using SSL. So you're using secure socket layer. And the way it's working is you're essentially using three levels of protection. So you're going in and you're using digital. So for online banking, you're going to be using SSL, and SSL uses digital certificates as the trusted channel for the public key. It uses asymmetric encryption as the secure channel for the secret key, and it uses symmetric for the confidentiality of the message. Because I think it is a helpful exercise, let me go in and show you real quick how SSL works to tie all these pieces together that we just talked about in our environment. So if we go in and we look at online banking is going to be going in and utilizing SSL secure socket layer, also known as HTTPS, and it's going to use digital certificates as the trusted channel for the public key. It's going to use asymmetric as the secure channel for the secret key, and it's going to go in and use symmetric for confidentiality of the message. And let me just show you this real quick. So if you go in and you open up your browser and you want to do online banking, you connect to your online banking site. I don't know about you, but when I do online banking, I only use the most trusted site in the business, which is the United States of Derek Bank of America. So I would go in to my www that in Derek we trust, and it would go in and set up an SSL connection. SYN-SYNAC-ACK to TCP port 443, which is SSL. Once the connection to your online bank is made via secure socket or TLS transport layer security, what's going to happen is your client is going to send its cryptographic information to the server. It actually sends a client hello message, which, by the way, I'm not kidding. If you're running a sniffer, it actually says client hello. It's a very polite protocol. Hey, you gotta love it. And it's gonna send its cryptographic info. Essentially, in order to do online banking, I need confidentiality, I need integrity, and I need authentication. So we're gonna have to agree on a symmetric, asymmetric, and hashing algorithm with appropriate key lengths. That's what the cryptographic information is. The cryptographic information is the client telling the server, hey, here's the algorithms that I support and the appropriate key lengths. The server would take that list, compare it to its list, and it would find a symmetric, asymmetric, and hashing that they both agree to. So once it does that, it's going to go in and it's going to send two things back to the client. It's going to send back the agreed to cryptographic algorithms. Remember, the symmetric algorithm will be used for confidentiality. The asymmetric will be used for authentication, and the hashing will be used for integrity. So it sends that back to the client, and the client loads that up in the browser. Then it's going to also send its digital certificate to the client. The client is going to go in and verify that it's a valid certificate, that it hasn't been expired and hasn't been revoked. If it turns out it's a valid certificate that hasn't been expired or revoked, it's then going to trust that this is the public key for that server. So at this point, step one is complete. We've used digital certificates as the trusted channel for the public key. Then your browser will generate a secret key. It will then take the secret key, encrypt it with the server's public key, and send it back to the server. So that's the secure key exchange, which is the secret key encrypted with the server's public key. The server is now going to go in and take its private key, decrypt, and get the secret key. At this point, we've completed step two. We've used asymmetric encryption as the secure channel for the secret key. We use asymmetric to get both sides of the secret key. At this point, the key exchange is done, and we now use the secret key with symmetric encryption for confidentiality of our information. So that's what's happening behind the scenes. Just all the steps we talked about are used in conjunction, which now means you will never surf the web the same, right? The next time you go to your online banking site or you go to e-commerce, you're not just going to sit back and look at that little key underneath. Now you're going to go in and hear this annoying New York accent in your mind going, digital certificates are the trusted channel for the public key. Asymmetric is the secure channel for the secret key. And symmetric is confidentiality for your information. Now, this slide is from one of our other courses, Security Essentials. Our rule with SANS is simple. For your course, your materials are only hard copy. So I can't go in and give you soft copy of all of the slides. SANS does not distribute those for the course. However, any add-on slides that I cover, I will provide those. So you will get an email from me where I will go in and have this slide, the drawings, the pictures, some of the reference stuff we've covered. I'll give you a little care package that has all of those extra things that we've covered. I can't give you the 410 slides in soft copy But all of the augmentation and additional materials that I covered, I absolutely will provide to you, so you'll have those available to you. So I can definitely send the slide over if that would be helpful to you. But that gives you a little idea of what's really happening behind the scenes. So when you go to that online banking site and it asks for your user ID and password, that's just going and proving that you are who you say you are, so you can access your information on the back end. So that's so you can access your back end information, but the actual transfer of the data back and forth over the wire is actually using SSL with what we've covered. Now, it really varies depending on the bank. Some banks, when you authenticate with your user ID and password, let you have access to your account, and the keys are stored right with your account. Not what we want, but some of them do it. Others will have a separate key server that when you authenticate, they will go into the key server, make the key available to decrypt your account information, and then re-encrypt the information when you're done. So that would be the data at rest, where you would use the symmetric encryption to protect that. Any other questions, comments on crypto? Excellent, excellent. Thank you for asking that. I always love when people start wanting to know real life and how it works, because that's when we really tie it all together there. So good stuff. So now that we finished up crypto, let's go ahead and wrap up our last day by looking at governance and then having some resources that we would use within control systems. So now that we've talked about the fundamentals and foundational material on day one, we talked about how the adversary breaks in on day two. We talked about securing and protecting our servers on day three. We talked about managing network communication and resources on day four. Day five is going to be everything else that's needed to manage our environment. From a governance perspective, we need to make sure everything we do is mapped back to risk. Whether we like it or not, security is all about understanding, managing and mitigating risk in our environment, which means before you spend a dollar of your budget or an hour of your time on anything in the name of security, you need to be able to ask yourself three questions. What is the risk? Is it the highest priority risk? And is it the most cost-effective way of reducing the risk? So we're going to spend a little time talking about risk, risk calculation, and prioritizing risks in your environment. We then need to make sure that we have the laws of security that govern people's behavior, which is known as security policies and procedures. We then want to tie that to business continuity planning, coordinate that with risk assessment and auditing, make sure that we're protecting and controlling our passwords, and then finish up with incident handling.